Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The Constitutional Convention of 1787 is one of the most important events in the history of the United States. After 4 months of painstaking deliberation, the Founding Fathers emerged with a document that continues to inform how we interpret the laws of the land. But the convention wasn't open to the public, so much of our interpretation on what happened there is based on accounts from the Founding Fathers, most notably James Madison. His notes are considered a top treasure of the American people in the Library of Congress and are the most complete record of what happened at the Constitutional Convention. As a result, they've become the main source of information on what happened during that hot summer in Philadelphia. But the notes were revised many times over Madison's lifetime, each revision presenting a different picture of the convention than the original writings. These revisions and their implications are at the heart of Mary Sarah Bilder's latest book, Madison's Hands, Revising the Constitutional Convention. Bilder spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and explains why Madison's notes have become so important.
There was an official record taker, that is a person who kept the official journal, and that was just the motions that had been brought. And we often think that legislative procedures and the convention would operate the way we think about legislative procedures, so we have access to what people say. But at the time the Constitution was written, people didn't believe that the public should necessarily have access to the deliberations. In fact, when Congress opened its doors, the House decided that the public could hear what people said, and they built galleries. But the Senate actually remained closed into the 1790s, and then under public pressure decided people had to be able to listen. So Madison took his notes, like other delegates, for himself, and I argue also for Thomas Jefferson. And the notes have historically been read as if they were taken by a stenographer. We call them notes, but they really haven't been treated that way. We think they were kept sometimes by a third-party person, but they were actually kept by a person who was incredibly involved. And what my book tries to do is think about how do we read those notes differently if we understand they're something more along the lines of a diary of someone who was interested in participating in the debates.
When we're thinking about the Constitution and we're thinking about the setting, who is James Madison? What is he to that creation of the Constitution?
Yeah, well, after the Revolution in 1776, the Congress that wrote the Declaration of Independence created a committee to write what they called a Constitution, a document that would help set up the governing structure. And we call that the Articles of Confederation. And that first constitution governed the country in the 1770s and 1780s. And then in the 1780s, it became increasingly evident to people like George Washington and a number of other leaders that that didn't work any longer, that the articles weren't useful for the kind of nation the United States wanted to be. For example, there was only one branch of government, and it was Congress. There wasn't a president, there wasn't a judiciary, and it was very difficult to accomplish anything in that Congress. So a number of people decided that there should be a new convention to try and alter the document so that the United States would be strong enough to resist invasion and had the power to fund an army and issues like that. And so they decided to have a convention in Philadelphia in 1787, and there were delegates elected from their states to participate. And James Madison was chosen by the Virginia legislature to attend.
We now think of him, and he is in fact often called the father of the Constitution, a moniker which you disagree with. But he's also, in this way, a representative, really, of the interests of Virginia, which were distinctly different than the rest of the colonies.
Right. He gets called the father of the Constitution towards the end of his life. In part, that's the product of the fact that he outlives everybody. He is the last of the framers to be alive. And the older he got, the more that people would come and ask him about what it was like in the early stages. And because everybody thought he had pretty good notes, but also because he had written the Federalist Papers with Alexander Hamilton, he seemed to be a great sage of the Constitution. And I think he's incredibly important in the convention. He loved politics. He participates. He left us a remarkable record. But I think it's important to realize that the Constitution was the product of a group of people. It wasn't just one person writing that document.
When we think about the notes now, a lot of what has become sort of intermingled and a lot of what you really look at are the revisions. So what is the timeline on those notes and how do those revisions change our perception of the Constitutional Convention?
What I did when I wrote the book was I tried to think about what did these notes look like as Madison wrote them. That is, what was it like to be him that summer? And to be trying to accomplish a certain type of government. It's not the government that we actually have today. And what do the notes tell us about that process? That is, I was very interested in using the notes to sort of bring back to life what it was like that summer. One of the things that is really hard for historians, but very important, is we know what happens in history, but the people at the time don't know what happens. So one of the great goals of history is to try and get back in a space where everybody doesn't yet know the future. And so the notes were sort of this opportunity. The problem with the notes is that they were revised by Madison over his lifetime. And he said this, and it was known when they were published. But people have largely sort of ignored the revisions. I tried to use those revisions to basically unwind the manuscript back to this moment in the summer of 1787. And when you go back and try and sort out what parts of the manuscript date from that summer as he's writing, you begin to have a sense of a very different type of situation. One example of that is that he had lots of little comments at the time that are the kinds of comments we would all write if we were keeping a diary, largely for ourselves and a friend, but then later on don't sound maybe so dignified. For example, there's a Maryland delegate, Luther Martin, who tended to give extremely long speeches. And at the end of Madison's relatively short record of that speech, with which he did not agree, he wrote along the lines, "This is the substance of a very long speech." And you can see in that moment, you know, he's sort of sitting there, he's exhausted, he doesn't agree with the speech, it's going on, and he writes that. Well, later on, he decided that that wasn't sort of the tone he wanted to have. And so he crossed that comment out. And there are similar characterizations of people who he disagreed with that are more spontaneous, that sort of get you back in that moment where they were really arguing about things. And then later on, again, he altered a lot of those words to make it feel much more moderate and objective. It was really fun because sometimes the convention feels, I think, almost a little bit boring to people because it does have this, through Madison's notes, moderate, quiet tone. But when you get back to what he wrote in the original version, you can sort of hear a little bit more of the frustration and disagreements and excitement of being there that summer.
When we think about the setting in which the Constitution was crafted, a summer in which many of these men were away from their families, you know, arguing day after day with one another about really trying to keep up this fledgling nation, I think it kind of informs the way that we look at it now. And one of the big things that you press, and you just had an op-ed about this in the Boston Globe, that the Constitution at the time was not written for forever. People at the time did not think like this was the Constitution, something reflected in Madison's notes. How did the revision sort of address the change in perception of the Constitution?
I think one of the most important things that we owe the framers is just enormous respect for their efforts in a moment when they really feared the country was going to fall apart. They were worried that the European powers would think the United States was weak and invade. There was constant anxiety about the idea that the United States might split into three sections. They were worried about a single strong person coming along and taking over sort of what they would imagine as a monarch. And so they were really working incredibly hard to design a structure of government that summer. And there were lots of things they disagreed on. And by the end, they were completely exhausted. I think they did want the Constitution to endure. They wanted it to stay into the future and stabilize the country. But I don't think they would have ever imagined that summer that we would parse it the way we do. We read it sometimes as if every single comma was given great thought. They honestly didn't even have the luxury to do that. They were trying to save the nation. And I really think, regardless of one's political beliefs, it's so important to appreciate that, the stress under which they wrote that document. One of the things that I find really interesting is that the Constitution, the way we look at it today, has seven articles. And we're so familiar with it that we forget that it didn't look that way until the very, very end. Going into August, the Constitution had 23 articles. And so the type of way that we think about there's an executive, there's a legislator, there's a judiciary, that's not even evident. That is a product of the second draft, and the second draft isn't even brought forward until basically a little over a week before they end. So one of the things that the revisions show us is that a lot of what we see when we look at the Constitution is the product of 200 years of people living under that Constitution. They just didn't imagine it yet that way. The concept of the Constitution is changing because we're the very first country to have a written Constitution. And we're the very first country to think that you could have a written Constitution and a separate judiciary and the judiciary would interpret it. So it's all kind of a great invention, but it's an invention where not everything's been completely thought out. And I think that's a wonderfully exciting space to be in. But it does mean that there's a lot of questions that we have to figure out more for ourselves.
Well, and your op-ed gets into this. The Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch has been referred to as an originalist. Former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was also sort of considered an originalist. First, for those who may not know, what is an originalist? And what do you find flawed about this interpretation of the Constitution?
Neil Gorsuch's confirmation hearings raised a lot of issues about what did it mean to be an originalist? What was this label that people were throwing around? And I honestly think there's a lot of different understandings of that term. There's a way that maybe the general public understands it, and then there's a way that legal scholars who have spent a lot of time writing about it understand it. The way that legal scholars who spend time writing about originalism would say is they believe that you can find in the text an original public meaning, and that what a judge should do is simply take any modern case, apply that original public meaning to it, and decide the case. Personally, I do not believe that that original public meaning is findable in any way that decides cases that are really hard. I think more importantly that for a long time, judges across the political spectrum decided these cases by using types of interpretation that combined understanding the historic origins and context, understanding how the Constitution had been altered, understanding how we would live under the Constitution, and that originalism suggests that the Constitution is a type of document that was literally beyond the capacity of the people in 1787. A lot of conservative justices have not been originalists, and it's only since the 1980s that there's been a sense that conservative justices should follow this type of judicial philosophy.
And this gets back to, of course, the creation of the Constitution, and sort of seems to at least imply that all the founding fathers were like, yes, this is the Constitution. Great. We've done a wonderful job, guys. But even James Madison didn't seem entirely happy with the way the Constitution came out.
No, James Madison was very upset even at the end of the convention. He wrote a great letter to Thomas Jefferson before the convention ended. Thomas Jefferson's in France at the time. And he really worried about the Constitution. Madison had not wanted the states to be represented directly in Congress. Later on in his life, he thought various other things about the states. But at the time that he participated in the convention in 1787, he wanted proportional representation in both houses. So the compromise that we take for granted, which is that the Senate represents the states, Madison hated that. Thomas Jefferson actually thought it was quite clever, and it may be Jefferson's acceptance of it that brings Madison around. And Madison also worried enormously that the legislatures, that state legislatures wouldn't be sufficiently controlled. He had wanted an idea that we find incomprehensible. He wanted the government to have something called a negative, which was a veto power. And he thought Congress should actually be able to veto state legislation. That's incomprehensible to us in our modern system. So in September, he was really not very happy. He then defended the Constitution in all sorts of interesting ways in the Federalist Papers that he wrote with Hamilton. And then in 1789, he introduced amendments to the Constitution. He had made a campaign promise that he would add a Bill of Rights, and so he actually worked very hard to fulfill that campaign promise. When the amendments go through the House and Senate, they don't look a lot like what Madison thought, but they do alter the Constitution. Madison wanted the amendments to be interwoven. He actually thought the amendments should literally revise the Constitution. Instead, Congress decided that amendments would be supplemental to the Constitution. That is, we would tack them on to the end. And this is a great example of how people really haven't quite figured out what a Constitution's going to be. I mean, we think it would be very strange to revise it, although some state constitutions are written that way now.
Well, and we're right now in Wisconsin looking at a push for a constitutional convention, an Article 5 convention, which would give people the ability to literally sit down and revise this document from 1787 that has really persisted for more than 200 years. When we're talking about an Article 5 convention, how does that really play out? Do we know?
The Constitution has two modes that you can change it. Change the actual words. One mode is that Congress can put forward an amendment, and then that amendment is sent out to the states, and then the states have to ratify it. And that's the mode that's been used since the beginning of our country under the Constitution, and it's the mode under which every single one of our amendments has been added. There's a second method that Article 5 says would be legal. It's the method that reflects the origins of the convention itself. It says that the states can call Congress to have a new convention. And so this would be a new convention. And then again, anything that they wrote would have to be ratified by state legislatures or conventions. And right now, it's that second method that some people think would be a good idea. That is, that we should have a new convention to rewrite the Constitution. Some people argue that that convention could be limited to a single issue. Some of the bills, and this may be the bill in Wisconsin, try to limit it just to a balanced budget amendment. But the Constitution doesn't provide for that. In fact, the Constitution uses the word amendments. There's no constitutional means to limit a convention once it begins to a specific agenda. So if you call a convention, you can't control the agenda. This is why the convention method has never been used. Everybody early on realized that if you call a convention for even one purpose, once the delegates get together, they can do all sorts of things. They'll basically end up rewriting the Constitution. So it's a very radical approach to amending the Constitution. And for 228 years, we've used the far more conservative approach of single issue amendment. The only time when the convention method was probably most influential was for the 17th Amendment. In the early part of the 20th century, senators were selected by state legislatures. That's how the Constitution originally was designed to operate. Senators weren't directly elected. People wanted the Constitution changed to have direct election of senators. In order to get the amendment, you have to persuade the Senate that they should pass an amendment that would change the way they get elected. So you can see why it was a little hard to get it through the Senate. And so that amendment failed in the Senate. A number of the states threatened to have a convention under Article 5 in order to bring pressure on the Senate to allow that amendment to change the way that senators were elected to go out to the states. And finally, the Senate agrees to. I think that they were one state short of getting an actual convention, And that becomes the 17th Amendment. So that's why we have direct election of senators today.
In this case, it seems, though, that people are not using it as a threat, but rather that this is the sort of first mode.
Right. And in 1911, what was, I think, very different was the senators had a real vested interest in not changing to direct election. And so the 1911 experience is, I think, quite different because there's a real institutional problem there where senators who would probably not get directly elected have a hard time coming to terms with the fact that everybody wants direct election of them. There's almost like an institutional failure problem that the threat of a constitutional convention helped to solve. I don't think the same threat is probably here. A balanced budget is more the type of thing that we expect Congress, which does represent the people of the United States and the states, to think about whether or not that's a good idea or not. So we don't have the same type of institutional problem that we had with the 17th Amendment.
Well, and I think this gets to another point that I think a lot of people get confused about, sort of the beginning of our nation, the founding of our nation. Direct election wasn't really nearly as common as it is now. The participants in presidential elections, of course, being an obvious example, that wasn't until relatively recent that parties didn't select their own candidate.
No, Joy, you're completely right. I mean, I even remember I grew up in Wisconsin, and I even remember how we had the very first election that I went to vote in the primary when we had the caucus system. It was, you know, a very different mode than I now vote in Massachusetts where I vote. I think one thing that always surprises students when we study the Constitution is how ambivalent the framers and founding fathers were about democracy and the way that we understand it. They liked the idea that the people were participating, but they were surprisingly hesitant about having the people elect everybody. And in fact, that's why we have the Electoral College. There were proposals at the convention to have direct election of the president. There were proposals at the convention for Congress to choose the president. In fact, the first draft of the Constitution had Congress choosing the president. And sort of in the last weeks of the convention, a committee comes up with what we understand as the Electoral College. It was a way to sort of have the population elect, but not really have the population elect. And our government was similarly with senators, state legislators originally selected the senators. So in the late 19th century into the 20th century, a lot of the amendments to the Constitution alter parts of the Constitution to bring the Constitution more in line with the way we understand democracy today.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for joining me and speaking with us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks so much, Joy, for having me.
Mary Sarah Bilder is the founder's professor of law at Boston College Law School, and she's the author of Madison's Hands, Revising the Constitutional Convention. Bilder was in Milwaukee yesterday to deliver the first annual McGaffey Lecture for the Department of History at UWM, and she spoke with Joy Powers.